Marshawn Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
We think of downturns as some sort of pain is necessary to readjust. And I think we think this because we think in moral terms, or we think in biophysical metaphors, where we're like, to get healthy, we have to run a lot, and we're going to get sore, and that's going to suck for a while, or we have to like lift weights, and that's going to feel really miserable. But we like come out on the other side stronger. It's not the right way to think about the economy. We can have better things without worse things. Like, this has just been accepted that to have better things, and it was really tragic. I mean, 10 years basically went on after the great financial crisis, watching Europe deal with like this pointless austerity and years of elevated unemployment. Why? What was the sort of better end?
Welcome, everybody, to our season opener. We are very, very excited for what this year has in store. Happy New Year to all you realigners that are out there. We have 120 episodes plus this year that we are planning. God, it kind of sounds scary, Marshall, when I say it that way. But when you think about what we're trying to do here, that's not even enough. I don't know if that's enough content.
That's the crazy thing. Everyone who's been with us since the start in July 2019 knows that we started as a once-a-week show all about DC politics and policy, with a special focus on the way that populism was really upending everything. As we got in, went independent, and expanded out to doing 2 to 3 episodes a week during the latter half of 2020, we started seeing that the realignment idea doesn't just apply to politics, it doesn't just apply to policy, but it involves every single aspect of our lives, from tech to business to the future of media, and they all come together to help us understand the way the world is changing and the way the world isn't changing. So that being said, today's opening guest, Joe Wiesenthal of Bloomberg News, is the perfect person to talk about all of this. Obviously, he covers Wall Street and finance, but during this episode, we're talking about everything from movie theaters to commercial real estate, why he thinks the 2008 financial crisis was worse than even the height of our pandemic recession. We're covering all those things because the key thing that we've learned over this season, and what so many of our guests and listeners have learned from, is that if you want to understand our world today, you have to get how all of this connects together. It's not just this world where you can look at politics and put that in a separate bucket from tech or any of the other subjects we cover.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Look, you guys know, Joe's been on the podcast. He's hands down the smartest person in my view who just does macroeconomics, stock markets, general takes about anything finance. So we wanted to have him on this seasoner just to dive into the stimulus debate. I got so many questions from you guys about $2,000 checks, $600 checks. Does it make sense? I mean, you guys were probably debating it with some of your family members. And actually, one of our listener questions, which we're about to get to, this is where literally happened. I wanted to bring Joe on here to make sense of this for all of you. And the best thing about Joe is he is an honest broker. Like, this is a guy who will be like, yeah, you know what? The stimulus, it was fine. It was fine and it was okay in these very specific ways. And it could have been better this way. We debunk left, center left, everybody that basically exists and their takes on this situation. So nobody goes unscathed. And we do the same thing whenever it comes to Bitcoin, whenever it comes to the Austin, Miami, big city debate. This is basically a narrative busting episode for everybody, and which is probably why I enjoyed it immensely. And I'm really glad that it's our first one back for the season. But as we mentioned, do not forget, if you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, you can ask us a question in that review or take a screenshot, send it into realignmentpod@gmail.com. Marshall, we have a question that directly relates to what I was just talking about. It. What is it?
So today's question is from our friend Brad. I'm a huge fan of the show. I was never interested in politics, and I just started listening a few months ago and have been hooked. My question refers to the continuing debate on stimulus negotiations. There's been back and forth on whether / how much money should be distributed in the new stimulus package, and I've been listening to Republicans, aka my whole family and conservative outlets, critique the stimulus checks as reinforcing lazy behavior through government handouts, a risk to the inflation, adding more money into the economy, which would increase prices, and so on. I've been an avid listener to the show and the podcast, so I know the benefits, but I can't seem to completely disavow these critiques. I don't agree with them, but they make sense to me, and I was wondering your thoughts and perhaps the implication for future perspectives on the topic for Democrats and Republicans. Thanks.
Great question, Brad. You literally have the perfect episode to listen to because we address that right here. I'll give you the Cliff Notes version. Look at this. That question that they are asking you presumes that the people who deserve aid are only the ones who, quote unquote, need help. And I would just turn that around and I would say, look, this has been a terrible year. Once in a lifetime pandemic. Americans, you and me, Marshall, all of us, we're locked in our houses. We were deprived the ability to go out, spend money, travel, do all these things. Same thing with businesses. A $2,000 remuneration payment barely makes up for any of that. And if you believe in trickle-up economics, this is the justification that Republicans use for tax cuts all the time, right? Which is put more money in people's hands and put more money available in the general economy, and consumption will go up, rising and lifting all boats. I think that very much applies to this. So the best thing that you could say is that government assistance doesn't just need to go to people who quote unquote need help, because in the middle of a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic, I think that it encapsulates almost everybody in this entire country.
That's the perfect way to put it. I get where you're coming from on referencing the term handout in the media. That's what your family is talking about. But this isn't just a handout. This isn't just welfare. This is, we have a massive, once-in-a-generation economic crisis. And we have a government that has the fiscal capability to halt that recession in its tracks. Listen on later in the episode. Joe will talk about this. We had the ability, and we used that ability, to use payments, the PPP program, and other forms of federal subsidies to prevent the economy from completely crashing, so that once we have the vaccine properly distributed, once spring, summer, and fall come about, we can do the best we can to reopen, to reengage, and get us back to where we were right before the pandemic. The key thing to think about as you think about this debate is, it took the country years to recover from the Great Recession after the 2008 financial crisis. What Joe argues in this episode is that the use of these stimulus packages and the broader PPP program are going to prevent a terrible recovery that will be impacting people in so many different ways. The last time Joe came on, the best thing he said was he turned the whole debate about we're hurting our grandchildren by giving them debt completely on its head. His point was, you know what would hurt your grandchild? You, the grandparent, having to drop out of college because your economic capacity has fallen out. You know what would hurt a grandchild? A family who supports a local restaurant not getting PPP loan, so the family's wealth all goes away. Those are the exact dynamics that happened in the 2008 financial crisis, and the fact that we are using these stimulus policies to prevent them means that we're not going to have that situation.
Extremely well said. Just as a reminder, guys, we have therealignment.substack.com. It's something that we really want to try and build up this year. And we have a lot of extra stuff there. So long listener emails, we freaking love those. We're going to put that in there for everybody to go and to read. You can leave comments there. We have full transcripts of all of our episodes. We have bonuses. And most important, actually, the one I'm really excited about this year is called our bookshop. And look, we have people on here who write books all the time. It's honestly one of my favorite things. And if you've listened long enough at this point, you know that Marshall and I are some reading nerds. And so we have a ongoing running list of 2021 book recommendations. Marshall and I are always reading three or four different books at the same time, which means we usually finish three or four different books a week. And if we really like them, you could check my Twitter feed, Marshall's Twitter feed. We're going to upload them to that bookshop. And Marshall, tell them why Bookshop is so awesome.
So aside from supporting our show, we get a certain small percentage of every single book sale. Bookshop.org actually supports local booksellers. So rather than selling an Amazon book, it is going to buy, for example, we're in Washington, D.C., it would source from a place like Kramer Books or from Politics and Prose or Capitol Hill Books, the sort of places that in many ways have been completely really hurt by the pandemic. Obviously, these providers can't give you the two-day shipping that Amazon has. So it's this great, perfect situation where you support the show, but you also support local booksellers as well. And I want to add to Sagar's point, not only do we have the ongoing list of books we're reading in 2021, but we also have all of the books that are more than 50 plus guests have written, and we have our Christmas recommendations that we posted up last month. So definitely go follow the link. It's going to be on the Substack, and we also posted a link in the show notes to this episode.
Yeah, it's a great place to go and get a gift. Enough talking. Let's get to the episode. Always a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for letting us do what we do here. We really appreciate all the support that they give us. And with that, let's dive in. We'll be right back.
Joe Wiesenthal, welcome back to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, good to see you, Joe.
Likewise.
I'm really glad that you were able to join us, man, because, you know, we were off for the last 2 weeks. We probably got more like listener mail and feedback and more than any time because they're like, what the hell's going on? $2,000 stimulus checks. It was probably the most like consequential week for policy and more in a long time, at least since the CARES Act and all of that. So maybe let's just get your immediate reactions to the ultimate result, which is we had this $900 billion package pass, whatever, $600 checks. A lot of people are upset about checks. Save your checks, hot takes, because those questions are coming. Overall reaction, was it enough? Was it not enough? What are the problems? What are some of the solutions that we should look forward to or look to try and implement and advocate for in the future?
So, you know, it was a big package that they put together. I mean, look, over $900 billion, or about $900 billion, that's more than the Recovery Act was during Obama's stimulus, during what in retrospect, and I think even at the time, was clearly a much bigger, more problematic economic downturn. I mean, I think the way a lot of people are thinking about the economy right now is that A, it recovered a lot more in 2020 than people expected, especially if you go back to expectations in the spring and early the summer. And B, most likely at some point in 2021 this year, we're going to get a fairly fast rebound as the vaccine rolls out. It's not off to a great start, but I think it's still reasonable to think that at some point in the middle of the next year, we will have fairly big, fairly brisk growth. And so the goal of this stimulus was basically to sort of build a bridge between now and the true reopening, when we can finally say, all right, we're returning to normal. And it's a lot of money. It's probably not perfect. It's not ideally targeted. There are going to be people who needed more help than they got. There are going to be people who really end up through this crisis in a significantly worse position than when it started, either through lost businesses, lost jobs, evictions, lost healthcare, and so forth. But it's a lot of money. And I think there is it puts us in a pretty good position overall to get to the other side close to whole, is how I put it.
I want to follow up on something you said, because it's counterintuitive to a lot of the received narratives a lot of us have, which is that the 2008 crisis was worse than this one in many ways, which we were both in high school then, so we couldn't feel it the way we felt it working out in the actual world here. But the economy wasn't closed. You didn't have the same degree of mass unemployment, it felt. Can you just sort of give people a perspective on that?
Sure. I mean, I think like when we go back and look at this particular crisis versus the previous crisis, and really versus past recessions and downturns in general, where I would start my analysis would be in analysis of household balance sheets. And that's a topic that I think a lot of people are very obsessed with and thinking about. We've discussed it on our own podcast a lot. You know, you think like 2008, 2009, what it really was just private sector balance sheets getting blown to smithereens. So many people's assets, their livelihoods tied essentially to the value of their homes. Home values collapsed. So you have these people who are millions of people massively underwater. And you have this whole economy back then sort of oriented in some way or so much around housing finance. And when that bubble, I guess, burst, that's, you know, you don't just put that back together. You don't just go back to the last bubble. And so you have so much of the economy, so much of people's wealth destroyed. And then over the years after the great financial crisis, then you sort of see household balance sheet repair, people paying down their debts, rebuilding their assets, and so forth. That didn't happen at all this time. And to my surprise, and to a lot of people's surprise, home values held up. The value of people's stock portfolios more than held up. Thanks to the CARES Act, there was not a lot of drawing down of savings. In fact, if you look at household savings in the aggregate, which is not to say every individual household, but combined, household savings have been very high, the amount of cash that people have in their checkings accounts. So when you add that in, checkings accounts, savings accounts, stock portfolios, home values, you actually end up with a private sector, an American household sector, weirdly, bizarrely, in a better shape today than at the start of the year in the aggregate. And I think what the lesson will be is that, yeah, this was a much more harrowing crisis by far in a sense because the fear of death and the fear of sickness and so much disruption to our lives. But because household balance sheets managed to stay intact, the healing process can be much faster. You don't have years of people having to focus on, in the aggregate, again, paying down their debts. And I always just want like to specify in the aggregate to acknowledge that millions of people are hurting.
Right.
But in the grand scheme of things and in the big picture, private sector balance sheets have held up very well.
So what's so interesting about that, though, is let's go to a couple industries where a lot of people who are much less optimistic on the recovery have focused. So, for example, commercial real estate.
Yeah.
That seems to be an area where if you're working in a city and you're making your money because there are a bunch of firms who are New York City, for example, that seems to be screwed. Movie theaters, Wonder Woman in 1984, despite being a terrible movie, actually did well at the box office. So that's probably a good sign that people will return. But that being said, there are a lot of people who aren't very bullish on movie theaters. So can you speak specifically to these COVID impacted sectors themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think like, look, there's no question that there's been an extraordinary divergence in sectoral winners and losers throughout this crisis. I mean, if you look at, you know, obviously companies like Amazon have done really well, Netflix, Peloton, but lots of e-commerce related companies have just done extraordinarily well. Lots of retail has done not terribly, particularly sort of like big box chain retail, grocery stores, Walmart and Targets and so forth. There's no question that sort of mom and pop, ground level retail in many cases, not all, but many have absolutely, I mean, it's been terrible for restaurants. It's been brutal.
Yes.
I think the two things I would say is A, PPP, the small business loans, the turn to grants, have done a reasonable job of keeping a lot of businesses afloat, keeping them potentially whole. And then the bigger picture, which I would go back to, is that a lot of what we saw as pain ended up being to the benefit of another another sector, another group of parties, which is not good in a sense, but what it means is that the pain is not at sort of the aggregate macro GDP level the same way it was in 2008, is more of a reorganization of the winners and losers.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who are already screaming at you, Joe, through their headsets. They're like, what are you talking about? This was a multi-billion dollar bailout of corporations, right. And I got absolutely nothing. You know, I only got, I actually kind of agree with part of that.
Yeah.
But I guess part of the bigger question here overall is how to evaluate it. It's kind of like what I like about what you're saying. You're like, look, it was $900 billion. It probably wasn't enough, but, you know, it's like a bridge. How should we think about this in terms of households? Because it's like you said, we got to acknowledge that there are millions of people who got completely and totally screwed by all of this. Do you think that the checks were themselves, the $2,000 checks, if they had been implemented, would have been an effective tool at doing something towards this? This has been such a huge debate amongst these policy wonks. They're like, well, we could, you know, have targeted unemployment, or we could fund the child tax credit for like 40 years with this amount of money. My argument is like, look, this is universally popular, but popularity isn't just the only reason to do it. But it's like, in the middle of a pandemic where everybody has suffered so much, like a payment like this, it's almost like a trickle down economics thing. It's like, hey, give people some money. It actually dropped a lot of poverty. Right?
Yeah, it did. But also it's trickle up because it's better than
it's better than trickle down. Yeah,
it's good. It puts money in people's pockets. It because it primarily doesn't go to the super rich, unlike say tax cuts. It goes towards spending. It goes towards consumption. That goes towards more businesses. You know, like the sort of like the checks discourse, as they say on Twitter, that discourse was not my favorite. Because I do think that by focusing so much on the singular checks, whether it was the $1,200 check that we got in the spring or the $600 check that was part of this bill, it kind of did give short shrift to a lot of money that went to the people that needed it the most. And our unemployment insurance expansion, income replacement, was actually one of the better ones, at least for those first four months, than anywhere else in the world. The focus on, or the many places in the world, the focus on the checks as if all we did was pass a $1,200 check was wrong. Same with this one. I mean, this latest, I don't even know, what was this latest one called?
I don't actually know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever.
They didn't do a very good job branding it because we all remember the CARES Act.
Oh, but, right. Because they tied it to the omnibus spending bill.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It wasn't even real. What a disaster. But we can talk about branding disaster.
Yeah. So anyway, I wasn't crazy about the like, oh, just $600.
Right.
And I think, you know, again, like, because I think the unemployment insurance expansion, that is way more important, in my opinion. The new tranche of PPP money, that's probably more important. The best argument for checks and probably expanded checks to go up to 2,000 was probably exactly this point, which is that not everyone who is suffering was eligible for unemployment insurance. Yeah. Some people had their hours cut, or maybe they weren't working, or whatever it is. And a fatter expanded check would have done a reasonable job of solving that. It wouldn't have really solved it, but it would have helped at what I see is not much cost overall. So I do think that there's a good argument to be made that the checks should have been bigger. But I also think that the focus on the checks misses the fact that there was a lot of money to a lot of things, and that's helped us get to at least the point that we are now.
See, I'm glad you said that, because this is where I want to split the difference. I can be pro-check and also support some of these immensely important government programs. Like, as I'm sure you saw, Dave Portnoy has got this fantastic restaurant fund going on. I think it's $17 million. I donated $500 to it. I absolutely support everything that he's doing, and I think it's amazing. But there's this incredibly annoying, like, libertarian meme, which is going on Twitter. Like, Dave Portnoy has done more for the restaurant industry than Congress. And I'm like, that's just not true. Like, it's just bullshit, right? I mean, like, we've had the Paycheck Protection Program.
Yeah.
We've had it now twice. Yes, one in five restaurants in America shut down. Half of that is government policy. I mean, that is a failure of government policy.
Yeah,
all around. Like, we need to give some credit to some of these programs and say, yeah, maybe it wasn't enough. So in that vein, what have been the most successful programs, not just in this bill, but like in general throughout this pandemic? Because I think there's actually a lot to learn here about what the state can do in a time like this.
Well, I think that, like, you know, you mentioned libertarians, and there seems to be like a cross ideological anger. It doesn't I actually can't put my finger on it exactly, because you have people on the left, you have like blue check liberal types, you have libertarians. There's like, it's not, I've never actually been able to like put my finger on exactly like who the complain caucus or the we just got $600 checks caucus. It's really hard to actually pinpoint what it is. But I think, like, actually, if you just want to from a left liberal perspective, I would say that, oh, we just got 1,200, or we just got 600, is kind of a corrosive meme in particular, because I do think that you want to, like, if you want good policies going forward, you should elucidate what's been done and what's been working. And it's incredibly striking that back in May, at the peak of, like, the sort of CARES Act dispersals, poverty in the United States actually fell. Like, we just need to, like, stop and, like, talk about that for a second. Poverty in the United States actually fell. Now, again, were there people who fell through the cracks in the CARES Act? Unquestionably. Are there people whose livelihoods were destroyed? Yes. Terrible. And I do think there's more that could be done. But if you're, like, thinking, like, oh, well, let's build upon what works, let's build upon something good, I do think it's worth pointing out that we can give grants to small businesses without much cost, without much damage. And I'm not using cost in a sort of like dollar amount, as in it costs us billions. I'm using cost as like, is there some drawback? Like, did we have inflation? No, not really. We didn't have inflation. So there's a lot we can do to repair household and private sector balance sheets. And that's, you know, we discovered that. And, you know, you mentioned libertarianism, and something I've been thinking about a lot is that I think when we come out of this crisis, the welfare state will look a lot better than the regulatory state, than the bureaucratic state. And that the two are fundamentally different. And so you look at like this, like, oh, like the vaccine rollout, absolutely abysmal. The testing ramp up in February and March, absolutely abysmal. Public health messaging, terrible, inconsistent. On the other hand, keeping the economy afloat, keeping people solvent, keeping people in their homes, the government has done phenomenally well for the most part. And they're two separate things. And I think libertarian critics of the government tend to collapse the two. And they say, like, a government is bad, it fails, and regulators, and let's cut the deficit. And they're, like, fundamentally, like, different things. And I feel like coming out of this, it makes sense for the sort of more libertarian-minded people to sort of, like, sharpen the attack by acknowledging that government spending, the sort of welfare state, can actually be very effective at raising, like, the general welfare. And that if there's an area that really comes out looking bad, it's more the bureaucratic state, the regulatory state, which has arguably seen failures for through and through.
Let's see, to push back on that, Joe. Okay. What's probably going to happen? I agree with you from the perspective of us, where it's three people talking about something. What libertarians are going to do is they're going to say the following. They're going to say, Joe, the only reason why the welfare state got involved is because government shut everything down. So government set the house on fire. And yeah, duh, if we print trillions of dollars in fake money to pay for a fire department to come down and fix the house, quote unquote, maybe they could fix that problem. And what they're also going to do is they're going to bring it into the national debt issue. And they're going to say, long term, my child, my grandchild, all these sort of things are going to go worse. But I do want to, so that's just, I want to hear what you think about the libertarian part. But on the second part, I want you to respond to our last, aka most destructive meme. Because what was so frustrating to me is that this crisis has really expanded my perspective on the smart MMT take. Mm. The smart MMT take, from my perspective, is basically pushing back on scarcity mentality within government. It's not about we could literally spend $20 trillion. Right. The point is that we could probably spend much more than our popular rhetoric and conception of government as a business would tell us. So we had people like Scott Galloway on, who, you know, I like Scott. Scott's very smart. But we're having this episode and he's saying, why did we do the PPP program? We just should have given money to people. Why are we giving money to businesses? Like, why can't we just do both of these things?
Right.
So can you just respond to sort of this left? This was a phenomenon of the center left and the center right. So we're not just trying to sort of criticize the far right and the far left here. Can you just talk about center left? Could you just respond to the sort of center left, center right scarcity mentality that in many ways was just counterproductive? Because by the way, the last thing I would say to the Scott argument is, well, there are a lot of people who don't want to give checks and don't want to support small businesses. Right. So you're not going to get a situation where either happens.
Well, I think I think there's a really good argument for supporting businesses and maintaining business solvency. And, you know, think about like, you know, MMT, you mentioned MMT, and one of the things that they talk about a lot is, okay, what is the constraint on spending? It's they say like the real resources constraint. So we have enough money to give everyone enough cash to buy a Tesla, but we don't have enough manufacturing capacity to give everyone a Tesla. And so that's like a sort of way to think about, there's no monetary constraint, but there is a real resources constraint. And if you pass a law saying everyone gets a Tesla next year, you'd have all kinds of problems because we simply like do not have the capacity to manufacture enough Teslas for 100 million drivers or whatever in the United States. But sort of real resources constraints, real resources capacity is really, it's not just about, do we have the factories? All the businesses that we're talking about, whether it's like a local like pizzeria or hairdresser or movie theater, these things are not easy to just sort of spin up on the fly. And this is like, I think, one of the really tragic aspects of this crisis, which is that we'll lose a lot of businesses that people will want when this crisis is over. So let's say the crisis is over sometime this summer in July. We will have diminished productive capacity, particularly in a lot of services areas, and people will want these things. And it'll be like, wait, okay, we had this, I don't know, maybe it'll be 18-month or 15-month crisis. Why did we need to lose restaurants and movie theaters and all these things? And you don't spin them up overnight. You don't call back the employees after 15 months and say, hey, come back, we're open now. Like, They may have moved. They may have gone other places. So the argument to me for shoveling money to large swaths of the business world is that supply side constraint, because we want that supply side capacity, the productive capacity of the nation, to exist for us. You know, one way you could think about it is, so when I was trying to use the term like winterizing, we want to winterize the economy. We keep it sort of stable so that it doesn't deteriorate, the pipes don't explode while we're in this sort of weird hibernation period, but then it's there for us when we get back. So I don't think that just giving money to households, even though that's extremely powerful, has a lot to recommend to it, and is something that we should do really in every downturn going forward, is enough for that reason, because you could risk getting to the other side with degraded capacity. And, you know, just one other point on this is, like, the virus is, it's nobody's fault. And I don't just mean that, like, in, so that's one reason I think it was sort of easier to pass more generous fiscal policies, that people didn't feel like anyone needed to be punished or anything like that. But even beyond that, it doesn't really tell us, like, what kind of economy we want going forward. Like, there's a good chance, I think, that, okay, yes, maybe we're going to have things like more digital services, work from home, stuff like that. This will accelerate that transition. But just because movie theaters weren't in a good position to ride this particular crisis out does not mean that the future does not include movie theaters. I think it does, or cruises, or airlines, or all kinds of things. We want that there at the end. Now, maybe, like, over time, again, market forces, maybe there won't be movie theaters one day. Maybe it really will be all streaming, and that's fine. Maybe, who knows? I don't really make predictions.
That sounds hellish.
I'm not into that, but, like, maybe, who knows, like, things, like, sometimes, like, industries do, you know, become obsolete or go out of business, but there's no particular reason to think that the entities that were hit particularly hard by the public health crisis, we won't want them on the other side, and so we should want to preserve that capacity. And I don't think you could quite do that just by giving money to households.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking about, and I'll direct this to you, Sagar, too. You're giving the really strong financial case for supporting the businesses, but I'm also thinking of the politics here. And small business owners are a huge constituency. So if you're someone who, like me, supported lockdowns, especially in April, May, June, we had absolutely no idea what was going on. The notion that we could have just closed down small businesses without any form of compensation or recompense and said, well, a lot of you guys are sort of wealthier, so good luck. That would have been insane, terrible politics that wouldn't have worked.
Yeah, this drove me crazy. I mean, watching the lockdown thing kind of hijack this whole... Joe, I've definitely vented to you about this as well, which is like the chief opposition in Congress, as I understood it, is basically we can't pass this new stimulus bill because it will fund blue state lockdowns. Like, that's basically what it was. It was like, no, we cannot give money to people in, you know, in, I don't know, what's lockdown? Like, Detroit or something. Chicago. Chicago is a good example. We can't give money to people in Chicago because we want them to suffer and rise up against Mayor Lori Lightfoot and force them to reopen the economy and go back to work. And here's the problem. Not only is that, you know, like, immoral and weird, but it's also not gonna work. Like, if you go and you look at, I mean, look at California. Like, look at, you know, there's a lot we can talk about, evidence, whatever, and all that. Like, there probably is, you know, a lot of populist backlash within the populace, but there's also a large part of the populace that is like, yeah, we'll support you no matter what you do. And so you just end up punishing poor people for absolutely no reason.
Right. It's kind of like this bank shot theory of politics. And I think both people on all different from all different perspectives at times sort of subscribe to this idea that you'll get good outcomes if, like, you induce some pain first.
Yes.
And
that'll teach
I don't
them.
Think that's a really, like, and you hear it on the left too, and you hear it with a lot of the left critics of the CARES Act, was like, oh, the Democrats had a lot of leverage in March and April and they squandered it because they could have, like, demanded more. And I just think that, like, you're really playing with fire there. You're really playing with people's lives, and you don't really know how the politics are going to work. So you might have some theory of politics where it's like you do this, and suddenly everyone in Chicago will be like, reopen the city. Oh, and while you're at it, let's change our pensions and slash teacher pensions and achieve a lot of other like sort of like longstanding priority goals. Like, you don't know how these things are going to work. And like, there's probably good arguments that the lockdowns have never been properly calibrated for all kinds of reasons. And I'm pretty sympathetic to that. But on the other hand, a lot of people just don't want to go out. Like, it's dangerous. We're thousands of people a day are dying right now of this. Like, it's a real, you know, we're gonna like several hundred thousand, 400,000 people may, I think the latest estimates I've seen by the end of January will have died. Like, this is pretty serious. This is a very serious public health crisis. And so the idea that, oh, it's just the lockdowns and everyone's like being irrational, like, it's not true. It's not right.
Joe, I just want to put a final nail in the coffin of a debate that I've seen that's really kind of bothered me, which is that these $2,000 checks are going to people who don't, quote unquote, need it. As in, why does a family, $200,000, couple kids, like, why do they need a $2,000 check? And here's my, and this is something you just talked about trickle-up economics, which is, yes, the most aid should go to the people who most need it, aka boosted unemployment insurance plus checks. But checks in the hands of people can also A, miss those who have fallen through the cracks, but B, there is a trickle-up phenomenon here, which I'm not endorsing like UBI or something. I'm saying in the middle of this global economic depression, putting some money in these people's hands can actually float up and help some of these businesses that are in the economy. And I think that that's one of the lessons that we learned with those $1,200 checks when we had them back in March.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, I mentioned it earlier, but I really think it's useful that people should start thinking about costs, not in nominal dollar terms, because it really doesn't mean very much. So if they say, oh, well, if we expand the checks from 600 to 2,000, it's going to be another half a trillion or whatever. I don't know the exact math.
Yeah.
And so people like conceive of costs as a half a trillion, as if like that really means something. But I think people need to think of costs in a slightly more useful framing. And I think there are two ways to conceive of economic costs when we're talking about government spending. One is theoretical inflation. So let's say you hand people like tons of money, and they just start spending money like crazy, and there isn't this capacity to absorb all this spending, and people are just shopping like crazy, and you could imagine it happening if you gave people enough money, and then you have prices going up, and so that's a negative. And then the other, I think, way to think about a potential cost of fiscal policy is if it exacerbates inequality, which probably has a sort of negative political cost over time and starts having a corrosive effect on society. Mm-hmm. So I think that like that's like how we need to conceive of these things. And I think $2,000 to even if a family has income of $200,000 does not impose a very high cost to society. It's not enough that people are going to spend so much that we're going to like, we're not going to have shortages of goods. I mean, we might a little bit. I mean, it's like, it might be hard to like book a Vegas hotel room next, you know, at the end of this coming summer.
That's a good thing.
That'd be a good thing. Like, we might have a little bit of shortages of that kind of stuff. But by and large, I don't think there's any like meaningful like costs associated with this. And so I think the benefits of this, more spending, more activity, more private sector balance sheet repair and so forth, definitely worthwhile.
Joe, the other thing that kind of confounded expectations here was stocks. This is probably the area where you're best known. All of your Odd Lots fans are here. They're waiting for this. What the hell happened with the stock market in 2020? There were a lot of doomer predictions. Then there were a lot of takes about how the stock market isn't real. I will confess, I said it a few times and I regret it after reading one of your best posts that you've ever written over at Bloomberg. And in general, this is more of a meta question. What do the markets actually represent here in this time? It's a snapshot of the U.S. economy, about, you know, graph of rich people's feelings. Just lay it on us.
I kind of do. Like, I sometimes people tweet that. They'll be like, oh, the stock market is like astrology for rich people, or like a measure of rich people's. I kind of agree with that. It's not totally wrong. But by and large, but no, in all seriousness, like, by and large, I've never really been like very comfortable with like this idea that like the stock market is like gets super disconnected from the real economy. There's a few things I'll say. So, like, A, if you just look at actual, if you were to like somehow like have a chart of the economy, which is impossible to do, but if you were like distill the economy into a single number, you would probably find that the actual real economy bottomed like around the end of March. That we had this like super hard collapse in real activity in the second 2 weeks of March. And then things like start improving. And there's a lot of evidence for that. If you look at mobility data, if you look at restaurant data, credit card spending data. If you look at initial claims, the worst week for initial jobless claims was at the end of March. And they've been steadily improving since then. So on some sort of directional basis, the stock market is clearly beat to the same drum to some extent with the real economy. The second thing I'll say is that stock market really is not meant, the measure of the stock market, the test of the market is not whether it aligns with the real economy, but does it reflect corporate profits? I mean, ultimately, that's the real sort of like reality that you want to benchmark equity prices again, is individual, the profits of the individual companies that make up the indices. A lot of companies that are listed have done extremely well this year. And obviously, some of the biggest have been like those tech companies that dominate the indices, and they've done insanely well. And so that's a huge chunk of the stock market right there. But, you know, you could like even like look at like, you know, then you like get into like a bunch of retailers have done incredibly well, or a bunch of like consumer products companies, or look at like a Johnson & Johnson, or a company that makes toothpaste, or a company that makes Tupperware, or a company that makes sneakers or whatever. Like, a lot of these companies have just done extremely well this year, period. And then, you know, there's other aspects of it. Like, I do think probably the fall in inflation, low interest rates, that probably has a positive effect on multiples. And so you get companies trading at a higher valuation than they otherwise would have had interest rates stayed higher. So that probably helps a little bit. And then you like think about also like long term, like we just look at this. The U.S. Congress and the Fed just showed that it can like knock out stop a recession in its tracks if it wants to. Yeah. This is knowledge that maybe if we're lucky, our politicians will remember in the future. And some of these things will be repeated. Hopefully we never know.
Wait, Joe, quick thing to take this back to our 2008 conversation, because that's a critical difference in the response. Yeah. The response this time was aggressive. It was quick. And that's the thing to build on there.
Yeah, exactly right. So like now, like you think, if you're thinking of an investor and you're like, okay, I'm going to value this equity, this stock over expectations over the next 10 years. And you figure every 10 years or 8 years or so, there is a recession. And so I have to like put in my like sort of like simulator, the odds that a recession like crushes the earnings of this company. But now I know that politicians can eliminate recessions like at the push of a button or if they really want to. That should, all else equal, raise the value that you would be willing to pay for a productive asset. So I think there are like a lot of things that happened this year. Look, it still blows my mind. The NASDAQ was up 40% in 2020. I won't lie, like, that's pretty weird. It's not exactly, like, it's not intuitive, like, that you would get that. But it also, like, does not strike me as, like, completely impossible to explain through logic. Or you don't have to reach and say, oh, it's an irrational bubble. And I tend to think that, like, this obsession with calling everything a bubble is, like, kind of lazy thinking.
Speaking of bubbles, depending on your perspective, we have to get your opening 2021 take on cryptocurrency. Bitcoin, Ethereum, everything. Bitcoin's up 300% over 2020. Give us something. Any take will do.
Yeah.
It's weird, like, you know what I was thinking about? This is, like, it's a weird thing. It's, like, 300% is, like, not that impressive. Like, in this sense, like, it was, like, you know, if you think about it, like...
Joe, I read that in a newsletter this morning, and I was so impressed to be able to say it, and you're like, that's nothing. Those are crap percentages.
No, like, think of how many things, like, went up, like, 300%. Like, you could have, like, I honestly, like...
Amazon stock, you mentioned actually.
Dave Portnoy, like, Penn Gaming, which bought up Arsenal, is up, like, what? 900% this year,
right.
Yeah, 1,000%.
Yeah,
I mean, Bitcoin is very big, and so it is impressive, but it's like kind of like it almost like 300%. It's like that seems kind of normal for like a high flying thing, you know. Like, it is interesting because Bitcoin crashed in the middle of March along with equities, and I was pretty surprised to see that. But I do think that we're starting to see that as crypto or Bitcoin specifically becomes more of an asset class. Or a thing that institutions invest in, it'll probably be even more and more correlated over time with risky assets. You know, it's like a cliche is that in a crisis, all correlations go to one. And by that means, it's like in normal times, like, I'm going to buy a little bit of this, sell a little bit of that. In a crisis, you're like, I need cash. I'm going to sell everything that's not nailed down, including the chair I'm sitting on and the microphone that I'm talking into because I need to pay the bills. And so the more like Bitcoin is part of institutional investors' portfolios, the more we'll probably see that in the future, that when there's like a boom in stocks, that like crypto and Bitcoin will boom. And when there's a bust, it'll sell off too. And I think we saw that pretty clearly this year.
Well, what's funny about that, Joe, is that if you're going to talk to the Bitcoiners, and there are many who listen, and look, I hold Bitcoin. I'm very open about it. I like Bitcoin. I think it's awesome. But the reasons that I like it and the reasons I'm hopeful for his future align much more with what you just said. Whereas they would tell you, and a lot of them are like, look at all this money that the Fed is printing and the balance sheets, and it's totally out of control. And people are finally flocking to a smart fixed asset like Bitcoin because Elon Musk can't go to the moon or can't go to, so what was it, an asteroid and mine gold like he can with gold, which is why Bitcoin is better. And I'm like, that is one of the dumbest takes on why Bitcoin is better than gold that I've ever heard. The other one is it's on a blockchain and it's online and you can send it to somebody easily. Like it's let's just destroy some Bitcoin myths here about why exactly it is surging right now. First of all, inflation. Do we have widespread inflation despite the fact that what is it like $1 in $5 or something has been created? They love this one. $1 in $5.
Yeah, that's like a fake stat. I mean, there's like, you know, like first of all, like one thing that people should recognize is that, you know, they think. Like dollars are created privately. So like banks create dollars all the time. The act of lending is the creation of dollars. Government spending is one source of dollar creation. But also like in a good economy, when people spend, when people borrow, when people make VC investments, that's the creation of new money. So all those stats about money printing are completely wrong. You know, I think that like I'm going to split the difference between your Bitcoin, rational Bitcoiner take and this sort of like Elon Musk needs to have something to for charging stations for Tesla on Mars and he's going to use Bitcoin for that, which is that even though I like find all that to be like total nonsense and that stuff about asteroid mining, diluting the value of gold and all that, if I think if it weren't for those people, like Bitcoin wouldn't go very far.
Totally
like, people
agree.
Love the
totally
fun of
agree
it.
With you.
In fact, I would even say like the rational Bitcoiner like yourself is almost free riding off the crazy Bitcoiners. Because you need them. You need them to tell amazing stories about charging stations on Mars to get people into the story. So even though like I think they're wrong and all their stories about inflation are like wrong and they're like not very like, good on like mechanics of how monetary policy work, it's part of the meme. I mean like to me, like the value of like Bitcoin ultimately is that, you know, like I could pay you in Bitcoin. Person A could pay person B without person C getting in the way. And that's a really big deal because as more commerce comes online, you know, there's fewer and fewer opportunities to pay in cash. And we live in a world in which centralized authorities dictate what you can spend on. And they'll say, oh, you're not allowed to spend on this. Obviously, you can't, you know, there's all kinds of things that a Visa, MasterCard, Facebook, PayPal, Square will deplatform you if you do violate. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be more demand. In other countries, you could be, you know, you could get in trouble for selling a religious text. for selling a Bible or something like that. And so I think that there's going to be ongoing demand for payment services that circumvent censors.
Yeah, so for our last section here, the big theme of the debates we've been having on the episode today has really been about what are trends that are happening, what's accelerating, what is going to stay the same. One of those big fights, which is fun on Twitter, but also speaks to a bigger idea, is the debate about whether or not big cities like San Francisco are over, yeah, and whether or not people, especially in the tech community, are going to move to Austin or Miami, which is a mix of tech and New York finance. So you're from Austin. Can we just get your perspective on the debate about decentralization, right? So are these big established places, you could say, we have all of Wall Street and we have Stanford University in Berkeley in our backyard.
Yeah.
Has COVID and the year 2020 really knocked away those long-term reasons that would make you bet on SF, even if you're not too happy about the poor handling of issues like homelessness and poverty, gentrification, etc.?
Man, it's a really difficult question. I have to admit, I don't have strong views on this. I mean, I tend to think that like the network of these cities that already exist, whether it's San Francisco or New York, will hold a lot stronger. Than people think. London is another example with, like, after Brexit, people were worried, like, oh, London's going to lose
right.
its place. London's not going to lose its place. Where else are people going to go? But, you know, like, look, it's nice to be warm. I get why people want to, like, leave New York or Connecticut and go to Florida. Being warmer, in my opinion, is better than being colder. So, like, that's pretty great. I think that, like, for some of the tech people specifically, it's a little weird because sometimes they're like, oh, work from home is the future. Also, we're all going to go to Miami. I don't really understand.
That's
like,
that's centralization.
Yeah, that like, you're just like, going to repeat it. Two, I think like there is something I've been thinking about a lot, and it's just sort of like, is that like there's obviously a lot of frustration with governance in San Francisco specifically. Homelessness is a problem. Home prices are a problem. I'm not really sure that like, bringing a tech industry to a city is like going to like do wonders for governance anywhere. I mean, Austin already has a very serious housing problem. Every time I go back to Austin, it's clear that the problem of homelessness is getting worse and worse. So I think that like any city that tries too hard to court this is probably inviting a lot of these same issues. I think another thing with tech is I do think that a lot of tech leaders, I'm not sure if they really believe in politics. I'm not really sure if they believe in engaging with politics. I think that probably a lot of them think that all these problems, whether it's housing or homelessness or free speech or whatever, are sort of like problems to be solved with an algorithm, distributional problems that could be solved with tech. And I don't think that like, I don't think that's realistic. I think like politics is always going to be here. So it's like, I think to some extent, a lot of the how these cities do in the future, whether it's Miami, Austin, Nashville, or wherever, will depend somewhat on the degree to which the new leaders of these places like really want to engage in politics, or do they sneer at politics and allow problems to fester? I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, I want to tease that out into kind of my final question up to you, because I know we got to get you out of here, which is that I think one of the most profound things of yours that I read, I think it was back in, maybe it was March, maybe it was April, and it was a post titled "It's a Choice" or something like that, just about yeah. how the decision to select discrete things that we do bail out and that we do let go bankrupt, give checks to, let unemployment expire, many of these other things would cause immense suffering. That was yeah. an explicit political choice. Like, it didn't yeah. have to happen. It was a choice that was made, and that is what I think you said. You were like, that's politics, actually. Like, the decision yeah. to allow something to happen is politics. And when I'm looking at these tech guys and they're like, yeah, we're going to go to move to Miami and all this, I'm like, it's like you just said. I mean, unless you actually care about politics itself, making choices, it's not just a program of housing. Right. It's about like, okay, well, which group gets the housing? Or what yeah. about the people who already live there? Do they like
right.
it? Like, what do these people think? Like, those are political choices. So what do you think, taking all that in mind, our biggest like lesson story of 2020 from your perspective was, having covered probably one of the most tumultuous economic years in what, modern history, since 1930 yeah. something? I don't know.
I mean, I think I'll just go with the really straightforward lesson that, you know, we think of downturns as some sort of pain is necessary to readjust. And I think we think this because we think in moral terms, or we think in sort of biophysical metaphors where we're like, well, to get healthy, we have to run a lot and we're going to get sore and that's going to suck for a while, or we have to like lift weights and that's going to feel really miserable. But we like come out on the other side stronger. And I think that that is a it's not the right way to think about the economy, that we can have better things without worse things. And it was sort of the point I made, we were talking about earlier about, you know, politics in Chicago and so forth. Like, this has just been accepted that to have better things. And it was really tragic. I mean, 10 years basically went on after the great financial crisis, watching Europe deal with like this pointless austerity and years of elevated unemployment. Why? What was the sort of better end? Now, you could say, like, okay, governments aren't run well in Europe. Or you could say businesses are corrupt or whatever. You could come up with all kinds of, like, ills that may be correct. But the idea that to solve them is needed, that pain is needed to solve them, I don't really think has much basis in reality. And here was a clear example where the politics came together because we said, you know what, this is an external shock. It's nobody's fault domestically. And so, even though millions of people did fall through the cracks, we took a response that was essentially like, well, this is nobody's fault, and we're going to try to make people whole, we're going to try to make businesses whole to some extent. And it's been more successful than people would have guessed. The economy is in a much better place today than people would have guessed at the beginning of April, without question. You look at the Fed's own projections of where they expected unemployment to be. It was still expected to be around 10%. It's currently below 7%. We don't need things to be painful to get better, because that's fundamentally a sort of moral thing, the sort of eat your vegetables mentality, or that we're going to pay for it, or something bad will happen, or something. And I don't think that's... I think what this crisis bore out is that we don't need to have bad things to get to better economic. We can just design better economic policy.
That is a great place to end it on.
All right.
Yeah. Thanks, Joe. Really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you both. It was a blast as always.
One second. Where can everybody find you? Twitter, your podcast, all that.
Yeah. Find me on Twitter. My handle is @TheStalwart. And check out the Odd Lots podcast that I co-host with my colleague Tracy Alloway.
Awesome podcast. Thanks, Joe. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. That was fun.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. As always, be sure to sign up for our Substack, check out our bookshop.org link, and give us a 5-star rating while sharing with your friends and family. Obviously, it helps us grow the show. Huge thank you to Lincoln Network for sponsoring us. We will see you on Thursday.